Why? She asks, then answers her own question. Skill sets, right. She shakes her head. Take them off your list. There are at least 2 dozen hillbillies around here who handle snakes just fine, and they're more likely to be mad at you. There's no point in asking why, but I do anyway. Any particular reason? She shrugs. Well, let's start with you being from out of town and go from there. I've been living at the lake for... I'm an outsider, and me and Dad moved to this place upward of 20 years back, she says. If you weren't born in these parts, you're not from here. For some, that's enough. Then add on the rumors, the internet bullshit. I'll be honest, it could be anybody. Great. I'd been hoping to end this day less paranoid, not more. Kez moves forward to study the mailbox. It fastens securely, right? Yes. No way that thing got in there accidentally. Nope. And it could have bitten Sam or the kids. It was just good luck I was the one who opened it. If it had been Connor or Lanny? It wasn't, she says. So let's focus on what did happen, not what didn't. At worst, someone just tried to kill you. Though I expect the county DA would plead that right down to criminal mischief. He isn't your biggest fan. No kidding, I say. I'm surprised he hasn't indicted me for standing here too long. Well, you know what they say about a good DA. He can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. Lucky that ours just isn't that good. I have to laugh, because Kezia doesn't usually smack-talk law enforcement, but she has a special contempt for District Attorney Elroy Compton. So do I. He's a silver-haired white man whose trial record consists almost entirely of convicting black defendants in a county racked with a mainly Caucasian-driven meth and prescription drug trade. He pleads out the white offenders, naturally. They're good people at heart, and other such shit. No matter how violent and depraved their crime, their church members will vouch for them. Their parents are fine Christians, the usual refrain. It reminds me painfully of those years I blindly believed in my monstrous ex-husband, unable or unwilling to see the truth right in front of me. Sometimes I think half the world has sunk into the same state of denial, and that makes me angry. Any idea who'd want to scare you like that? Kezia asks. Are you serious? Most of Norton still believes I got away with the local murders, for a start. And that's not even counting all the trolls, the stalkers, the families of Melvin's victims. Criminal hackers from the Absalom Collective who slipped the net, she finishes. Yeah, I know. I was hoping for a more specific enemy, because pretty much everybody doesn't narrow it down that much. I know, but right now it's what I've got. She taps her pen against the pad of paper she's using for her notes. Yeah. Not sure you helped with what went on TV today. What about the woman? The one from your interview? I don't want to believe that. But the fact is, the most die-hard fanatical harassers were, for a while, the family members of Melvin's victims, including Miranda. Miranda Tidewell? She might put arsenic in a mint julep, but snake handling? I really don't think so, I say. But she might hire someone to do it, just to scare us. She did seem like she was on a mission to prove you were... A monster? Yes. She's always been, since my trial. I just thought... Well, I hoped that she'd moved on. These days we've got obsessive freaks for everything, she says. Especially if it's complicated and stupid. Sorry. Hate to say it, but Gwen... Yeah, look out for myself, I know. I'm on that. She studies me. You forgot to carry, didn't you? I didn't forget. I left it in the truck while I came to get the mail.
Truck's up there, Kez says. And you're a sitting duck out here. You realize that?
I did once I was stuck watching the snake. She nods.
Good. Don't do that again. Most jackasses around here, I wish they'd leave their damn guns in the safe. But not you. You actually do need one, so make sure you have it. I give her a smile, thin, because I know she's right, and I'm smarting a little from that. Message received, I tell her. I realize how dark it's gotten. She usually walks her father uphill to his cabin well before this. Did you get Easy home already? Yeah, that's why I wasn't here first, she says. Sorry, but I had to see him safe. Good. And you're heading home? To Javier's, she says. Javier is her lover, maybe even, though I haven't asked, her long-term partner, but they still live apart. Hey, Beto, you done? Done, he says. He's closing up his kit. Didn't get a lot, a few good prints, but they'll probably be either the families or the postal workers. Maybe we'll get lucky. Maybe, Kezia says. Thanks, man. Get home safe. You too. Her gaze suddenly shifts and focuses as he moves to his truck. She's looking uphill, and I follow her gaze to see Sam heading down toward us. So you've got some explaining to do, she says. Good luck, girl. I'm rolling. Javier's waiting dinner. She's gone before he gets there, and he watches her drive away as he comes to a stop just a couple of feet away from me. So, he says. Lanny said you lied about being okay. Next thing I know, Kez is here plus two more cars. What the hell is going on? I sigh. I'd been hoping to avoid this. Let's go inside, I tell him. Better I catch everybody up at once. I make a detour to the truck and retrieve my firearm. The instant I have it, I feel steadier. I know that's wrong. The gun doesn't make me any safer, just more capable of retaliating. PTSD, lying again. I'm going to have to train myself out of using a weapon as a comfort blanket. It's a necessary evil for me, but that shouldn't mean I need it. Gwen? Sam's concerned. I give him a smile I don't really feel. Ready? I say. I'm really not. As soon as we come into the house, I lock the door and set the alarm to stay. Lanny stands with her arms crossed, hip shot. Connor even looks up from the book he's reading. They're waiting for an explanation, too. How's it coming? I ask, trying to sound normal. It doesn't work. Lanny keeps frowning at me. Connor shakes his head, and Sam's look says that I am failing miserably at reassurance. Okay, I say. So there was a snake in the mailbox. A what? Lanny bursts out. I've surprised the frown off her face. Sam stops stirring. What kind of snake? Connor asks. Was it a copperhead? I've seen a copperhead before. Not a copperhead. I don't want you to worry. My voice fades, and I realize that I have to do this. I'm lying. I do need you to worry. I need you to understand that after the day we had, things are not going to be the same. You need to be extra careful. And from now on, Sam and I will get the mail. Okay? Mom, we're always extra careful, Lanny says. Come on, you know that. But they're not. They're not. And it makes me feel sick all over again to think about Connor opening that mailbox, or Lanny, or even Sam. Though his reaction time is even better than mine. My kids think they're paranoid enough. They never can be. Not enough to prevent anything that might come for them, and that overconfidence could be deadly. Sam's watching me very steadily. Hey, kids, give us a minute, okay? Connor, go stir the beans, and you owe me a salad, kid. Okay. For me, Connor would have sighed as if the weight of the world had landed on him. But Sam just gets a compliant mood and instant acceptance. I envy that. Lanny checks her phone. The chicken's almost done, she says. Like 3 minutes. Then take it out when it's ready, Sam tells her, and disarms and unlocks the front door. Gwen? I follow him out. I don't like being on the porch right now, and I turn out the lights. We're plunged into darkness until my eyes begin to adjust. What's going on? he asks me. I don't know, I say. Snake in the mailbox has me on edge, obviously. So does what happened today. I just feel...
exposed, he asks.
Puts his arms around me. I'm sorry, I really am. I know you didn't want to do that damn show in the first place, and I'm sorry I didn't warn you off it harder. I had a bad feeling, and I'm sorry to be right. I still didn't think they'd dare pull that, not after all the agreements.
Neither did I, or I never would have been there.
I relax into his warmth, his strength. I can disarm for a moment here with him, even if it is out in the open. Maybe we'll get lucky. Maybe somebody left a fingerprint on the mailbox.
You never answered the kids, he says, and tips my chin up.
It's dark, but not dark enough that I miss the look in his eyes.
What kind of snake was it?
Timber rattler.
Jesus, Gwen.
I know. I rest my head against his shoulder. I'm fine. The snake's fine, even. No harm done. He has a lot to say about that. I can sense it. But he holds back. I can tell he brought me out here to talk about something, but I doubt it's the snake in the mailbox. Odd. He usually doesn't hesitate to bring up uncomfortable things. I think about how strange this is. Every once in a while, it hits me. Sam is the brother of one of Melvin's victims. By any logic at all, he shouldn't be here, and we shouldn't have... this. It didn't start that way. I didn't trust him, and he believed deep down that I was guilty. It's taken time and work and pain to get here to this moment of trust, of peace. And it's still fragile. Even though we've built that bridge, it isn't steel. It's glass. And sometimes there are cracks. After a long moment of silence, he says,
"Listen, about Miranda Tidewell. Did she say what she was really planning?
Just some kind of documentary. For release everywhere, I guess, or as wide as she can manage. I'm going to guess it won't be flattering.
I try to make that sound light, but it isn't. It can't be.
Miranda Tidewell is filthy rich and brutally angry, and if she can't take an actual hatchet to my life, she'll do it with a metaphorical one instead. She understands the power of the medium.
Gwen? He moves his hands from my waist and cups my face, a wonderfully gentle gesture, something that makes me catch my breath. How are we going to do this? Tell me. Tell me how we protect the kids from this.
I don't know, I tell him. I feel tears prickle at the corners of my eyes and blink hard to keep them from forming. Maybe we can't. Maybe we have to help them learn to live with it instead.
God, he says, I hope you're wrong. I really do.
When he kisses me, it's sweet and gentle, with an ember of heat beneath it. A little desperation, too. I feel that. We're always ever standing on the edge of a cliff with some long, dark drop below. Right now, that cliff feels especially precarious.
Food's ready, he says. How scared do we all need to be?
Very, I say. I need you and the kids to be on guard. I hate that. I hate taking away the small bit of normality we've carved out for the kids. But they're going to have to understand what might be coming. We lay it out over the dinner. It's rosemary chicken, my favorite. That was sweet of them. The chicken's delicious, the beans done just right. The salad is a mess, but my kids are trying. None of us really taste any of it, I think, as we talk about the possibility that Stillhouse Lake may get more and more hostile for us. We talk about awareness and staying with friends and adults we can trust. We talk about what to do if things go wrong. It's not a fun conversation, but it's necessary. The kids don't protest. I see Lanny's mutinous anger. She's just gotten to an age where she wants her life to get bigger, not smaller. Connor's less bothered. He's been introverted since well before this, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. but I have to keep a close watch on my daughter. They ask to be excused. I let them go with their plates half finished, and Sam and I clean up the kitchen. I keep glancing over to be sure I've set the alarm to stay. He notices, but he doesn't comment. I wash the plates and pass them over, and he dries and puts them away. It's done in a comfortable, easy silence, but my mind keeps going back to the studio, the frozen horror, the way I lost it on live television. It's like touching a hot stove, but I can't stop. I'm almost grateful for the distraction when the home phone rings. I keep a landline for safety reasons. 9 times out of 10, it's some recorded voice trying to scam me. But landlines don't go down nearly as fast in a crisis as cell phones, and they're not reliant on either battery or house power. I feel better having it as a failsafe. I reach for the phone, then pull back. I don't recognize the number, so I listen as the recorder catches the call. Old-fashioned, but this way I can screen calls and pick up if I recognize urgency. I've got the volume low, and I'm prepared to walk away. But after the greeting starts, a real human voice on the other end says, hi, I'm looking for somebody named Gwen Proctor. I get a sick feeling in my stomach. I've fielded lots of abusive phone calls, of course. Nameless strangers who want to kick me while I'm down, shouting insults. Nameless men who tell me in detail about their fantasy of raping and murdering me, or my children, or both. A creepy more than few who tell me they loved me at first sight and knew we were destined to be together. If only I'd just understand. Then that hesitant female voice continues. Please, I'm begging you. Please answer me. I don't know where else I'm supposed to turn. And I know. It's one of those calls. It started with a random call. The distant friend of a cop who had my number. A woman crying months ago, begging me to tell her what to do because she didn't know how to stay alive. She was the mother of a 14-year-old boy who'd abducted, raped, and killed a neighbor's 5-year-old, who'd hidden the body under his bed for 3 days. She'd found it, reported it, turned in her own son to the police. She hadn't been prepared for the terrifying truth. People blamed her, too. Blamed her for raising a killer. Blamed her for not knowing, not stopping him. I'd spent an hour trying to help her find ways to deal with what she was going through. In the end, I looked up a domestic violence shelter where she could at least hide out for a while. I don't know what happened to her. But she told someone else who'd contacted her about me and how I'd helped. And so on. For the past 3 months, I've been getting these tragic, disembodied voices begging me for help and answers I don't have. The best I could give most of them was understanding the cold comfort of knowing they weren't alone in this nightmare. Sam's watching me, and his expression says, "Don't." And he's right, of course. We don't need more trouble. I almost let it go. I can hear her breathing. Hear her choking back a sob. "Okay, then," she says, and I hear the dull defeat in it. "Sorry I bothered you. I'll hang up now." I grab the receiver. "This is Gwen," I say. "What's the problem?" There's a deeply indrawn breath on the other end of the line. "Sorry," the woman says. "I figured I could get through this without being such a damn mess. I guess I'm not like you. You seem pretty near made of steel, from what I'm told." I still have no idea who this is, or what it's about, but I have an instinct that I should listen. "Oh, I'm not. Believe me," I tell her. "It's all right. Take your time. What's your name?"
Marlene, she says. "Marlene Crockett, from Wolf Hunter."
Her accent is pure, rural Tennessee drawl.
"It's up around the backside of nowhere, I guess."
She laughs nervously. It sounds like cracking glass.
"Never heard of it, right?"
She makes it a question, so I'm honest. "I haven't,"
What do you need from me, Marlene?
She doesn't get right to the point. I recognize the tendency. She wants to circle around the point, work up her courage. She tells me about her town, about her frustrations with her job, about the patch of grease she just can't scrub off her wood floor. I wait her out. Sam finishes the dishes. He writes me a note and slides it over. Got some work to do. He heads back toward our shared office. We have partner desks in there now, set a decent space away from each other. Sam's both working freelance as a laborer on construction projects and running a couple of small commercial jobs for a firm out of Knoxville. I'm maintaining an online accounting business that takes a few hours a day, with some graphic design on the side. I'd be more financially secure with a day job. But then again, I like being home with my kids, especially during these epic long hot summers. And I like the idea that I can, even now, drop everything and run at a moment's notice. It'll take a while for me to gear down from that impulse, if I ever can. I finally judge that she's winding down, so I cut in. Marlene, how did you get this number, exactly?
A lady said on social media about how you weren't no monster, like some say, and you helped her. I asked her if you might help me, too. She said you might and gave me your number.
In the open? On her social media?
By email, Marlene says.
She sounds even more nervous.
Was that wrong?
At least it wasn't posted on the internet, but still, I need to change this number. Or get rid of the landline completely.
Who was it?
Don't know her real name, but she goes by Melissa Thorne. Melissa and I are going to have a talk.
Okay, I say. Can you tell me what's wrong?
I expect her to say something about her boyfriend, her husband, someone else in her family, even a friend. But she says,
it ain't wrong with me, exactly. It's more like it's this whole damn town. Well, some people in it, I guess. Though this place here has never been good land. Got blood soaked in it from the jump.
This is going nowhere, and I'm starting to think I'm being played. Maybe she's just a lonely time waster. I'm giving you one more minute to tell me what I can do for you. Then I'm gone, and I won't take your call again. Understand? She pauses.
I understand.
But she doesn't go on. Silence stretches. She finally says, all in a rush,
so if something bad's happening around here, what can I do? Can't go to the police, no way. What do you do if you don't trust folks in town?
I can help you with some state agencies to call, if that's what you're asking. But you'd better be ready to tell them what your problem really is, I tell Marlene. First, are you in any physical danger right now?
I don't think so. But it's hard. I don't know what to do about it, or where to go. I just don't want to get myself in worse trouble than I'm already in.
She sighs heavily.
I'm a single mother, and my girl, she's a handful, you know. I got no people here, nobody to help out. I gotta be careful. It's real complicated.
It always is complicated, from the inside. People on the outside looking in seem to think it's simple to cut ties, walk away. But there are so many ropes holding a person down. Children, extended family, friends, jobs, money, obligations, guilt, and fear. So much fear. The most dangerous time in any woman's life is when she's separating from a partner, particularly an abusive one. Women instinctively know that, even if they've never seen the blood-drenched statistics. Sometimes it feels safer to endure the devil, you know. I know it can feel like you're in a trap with no way out, I tell her. But that's not true. You always hold the key to your own cage, okay? You just need to find the courage to use it. Is the problem with your husband? She sniffles, as if she's on the verge of tears.
No, he's dead.
A boyfriend? Someone you dated?
No.
Okay.
That's pretty new. Most calls I get are about husbands or domestic partners, occasionally about unknown stalkers. So, specifically, who is threatening you right now?
It ain't threats. Not exactly. And I can't say no names, she says. It's just, if I tell somebody and it comes back on me and my daughter, it'll be real bad, you know? And if I don't tell nobody, I don't know how I live with that.
I'm sorry, I say, as gently as I can. But I'm not a therapist or a lawyer, and whatever you tell me might cause legal problems for you in the future if you've been part of something illegal. Understand? If you want to talk about something that frightens you but isn't a crime, let me put you in touch with a psychologist or psychiatrist.
I'm not going to any shrink.
She sounds offended. Small, rural towns haven't exactly embraced talk therapy. Okay, if you think it might be criminal, Marlene, why do you think you can't go to the police? She doesn't answer that. Just silence on the line. Are you afraid of them?
I'm afraid of everything, she says.
What about the state police? She sucks in a breath, then lets it out.
Maybe that'd be okay, I guess. Not sure if they'd believe me about this, but I could try.
Then I urge you to make that call. Sometimes lives can be lost if you wait, and then you have to carry that responsibility forever. My mind is racing to fill in the blanks. Is she talking about a neighbor under threat? A friend? Something else? I can't tell.
Yeah,
she says. I can hear her pacing restlessly.
Yeah, I know that. But this is a small place. Hell, half the town is related. I guess I have to figure this out myself, and...
She stops on a dime, and I don't even hear breathing. When she talks again, it's in a hushed, rushed whisper.
I gotta go. Sorry.
Marlene, if you can't tell me what's going on, I don't know how to help you.
Come up here, she says. Come up here and I'll show you everything. It ain't far where they buried the wreck. You decide what to do about it.
The wreck? Buried? That doesn't make any sense.
You mean come to Wolf Hunter?
No, I can't. No way am I going to some isolated rural location, armed or not, ready for a fight or not. No, the risk isn't worth it. Not anymore. Call the state police, will you do that? She doesn't answer. With a quiet click, she's gone. Call ended. I shake my head as I hang up. It's unsettling, but I don't know what I could have said or done differently. Whatever's going on with her, it's strange, and I can't help but be suspicious. I just found a snake in my mailbox. Now a mysterious caller is trying her best to get me to drive off into the lonely hills. I'm not getting drawn into a trap. I've got enemies. Today only confirmed that. I linger near the phone, waiting for a call back, but it doesn't come. I finally head toward the office. I stop along the way and pop my head into Connor's room. He's reading, which is exactly what I expected, and I don't bother him. It's hardly a surprise to find that Lanny is texting, and she barely glances up when I knock on her open door. Hey, she says. Who was it calling? Someone who wanted advice, I say. Her fingers stumble and pause, and she transfers her attention to me. My daughter's pretty, but more than that, there is character in her face and strength. A fair bit of sharp stubbornness, too. Can't imagine where she gets it.
What did she want?
Honestly, I'm really not even sure. She doesn't seem to be in too much trouble, though. Not in fear of her life, at least not enough to really accept help.
Kay.
She goes back to her glowing screen, thumbs working with furious precision. I love the way she attacks things, with all the intensity of a life-and-death situation. My beautiful Atlanta, never moving at less than full speed.
I hate this, you know?
She's talking about the danger, the restrictions, the way her life keeps drawing inward.
I know, I tell her. We'll try to make it better.
When I get to the office, I find an open bottle of wine and a full glass on my desk. Sam's got one of his own. He's got his cell phone cradled between his neck and shoulder as he searches in a drawer for paperwork. I take the glass and mouth, "Thank you," as I slip into my own chair. I check my email box. It's a damn disaster. I suppose I should have expected that in the wake of the Howie Hamlin debacle, but I hadn't. And seeing the huge increase in abusive anonymous emails makes me regret having dinner first. I ignore those for now. Most are repetitive anyway, like they passed around a script. "Kill yourself, you ugly bitch. Do everybody a favor and join your husband in hell. Start a barbecue and crawl inside." That kind of thing. Once I clear those out and into a "for evaluation" folder, I get rid of the flood of reporters wanting me to comment on the upcoming documentary. Someone's helpfully signed me up for a Lost Angels newsletter. How nice. Apart from those, there are 4 more messages, each containing automated web searches that I've programmed to archive monthly to my inbox. I've slacked off the sicko patrol for too long, obviously. At first I was recovering, and then... then I convinced myself that with Melvin gone, Absalom gone, things would just get better. That I didn't need to worry as much anymore. I was an idiot, and I'm paying for that brief, stupid burst of overconfidence. I start as far back as I can find and open the report. It's just an archived list of links mentioning either Gwen Proctor, Gina Royal, or any of the other briefly used false names I'd hidden out under. The date is soon after the events at Kilman Creek. Seems normal enough, if you can call mutilation, rape, and death threats normal. And of course, there are a lot of them. Hundreds. What's more ominous is that when I open each of the reports, I can see the cancerous growth, charted out in ever-proliferating links to videos, discussion boards, new Facebook groups dedicated to stalking me, Twitter hashtags. And that's just on the public side. The dark web is mostly inaccessible to me now. I have a Tor browser that grants me anonymity, but the dark web is a who-do-you-know network, full of shadowy contacts and hidden agendas. I used to rely on the hacker collective known as Absalom to navigate that world, but back then I didn't know who, what Absalom really was, and really wanted. Without that easy access, the searches I can run in the deeper levels of the internet are very limited. But I can see the surface, and the growing monster. Day after day of commenters feeding off one another's fear, paranoia, hate, and easy judgment. There's a link to the Lost Angels website, finally. I click it, but I can only get to the public homepage of the site, the one with all the photo montages for each of Melvin's victims. It's difficult for me to come here at all, looking at the calm, smiling, hopeful faces of young women just starting their lives, the innocent babies and children they once were before my ex got his hands on them. I keep scrolling. There's usually a news section at the bottom beneath all this heartbreak where members of the Lost Angels community, families mostly, though some close friends too, will put updates they feel are important. This time, it isn't just a post recalling a birthday or a graduation. It's a full press release, dated only a couple of weeks ago. It announces that filming on a Lost Angels documentary is underway. Not just about the victims, but about the killings themselves. About Melvin Royal. Most especially about the woman who might have gotten away with murder. Gina Royal. I feel sick. I understand their pain, their rage, their need for some kind of relief, and I've never hated them for despising me. The one thing I can be grateful for is that at least so far, there's no mention of Sam in connection to the making of this film. A significant number of people got on board for this project, almost 10,000 of them, pledging hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's matched by the nonprofit that Miranda Tidwell started for her murdered child. I feel even sicker, staring at the announcements, and the promise of more to come soon. They're really doing this.
They're really coming for me.
Sam finishes his conversation, and I hear him call my name, but I don't immediately respond. I can't. In an effort to get my mind off the lost angels, I've clicked another link. Now I'm staring at the message on my screen that says, "Open season on murderers," and it's a surveillance picture of me, Lanny, and Connor, laughing together in front of our cabin, unafraid. There's a target drawn over us, and painstakingly photoshopped bullet holes in our bodies. Sam comes around the desk, and I quickly minimize the picture to the desktop, but not soon enough. He leans over and commandeers the mouse, brings it up again, studies the image. I know that silence. Sam's currents run deep, fast, and sometimes dangerous.
"What are you thinking?" I ask him.
"I'm thinking this gets printed out and taken straight to the police," he says, "and to the FBI. We have friends in both places, thankfully. And I'm thinking that whoever took this was right here, watching you. And I want to know who the hell that is."
"The original photo could have been taken by a journalist," I tell him. "They've been after us from the day Melvin went down. Since I never gave much in the way of interviews, they shot a lot of pictures, usually grainy, long-lens shots like this. It doesn't mean this Photoshop hero who changed it has been or is anywhere close to us."
"It doesn't mean he isn't, either," Sam says. "Sorry, I take this seriously."
"You think I don't? This isn't even the worst of it."
He doesn't quite look at me. "That's what I'm afraid of. I'm going to have to let him in on all this. I've hesitated, because there are some particularly awful things in my sicko patrol file. Things that feel, even now, too intimate to share. But he needs to know."
"Okay," I say.
"You want to sit down and look at the rest of what I've got?" I see the flicker of shock go through him. He pulls his chair over and leans forward, elbows on his knees.
"Sure,"
he says. "Let's go." He thinks he's ready. But I register the revulsion and horror in his eyes as I scroll. Nobody's ever really ready. Not for this.
Chapter 3. Sam. Just knowing that Miranda Tidwell ambushed Gwen on the show this morning was bad enough, but hearing about the documentary she's planning sets off a storm of white noise in my head. I can't process that Miranda Tidwell and Gwen Proctor can occupy, however briefly, the same space. I've held them completely separate in my head, in neat, contained boxes, never to meet. But life doesn't work like that, and now that Gwen's told me about the Lost Angels documentary, I feel like I'm starting a slow fall down a deep, dark well. There's an impact coming, and it's going to be deadly. All I can do for now is pretend it isn't happening. I'll keep living my normal life, my real life, for as long as I can. Because what Miranda represents, it's dead, as dead to me as Gwen's marriage is to her. I tell myself that, even as I recognize that Melvin's ghost has never stopped haunting either one of us. Dead doesn't mean gone. Watching the sick parade of trolls and their dark, inventive ways to hurt her, I'd like to say that it surprises me. It doesn't exactly. It feels all too horribly familiar. By the time we're halfway through, I'm numb to most of it. I'm sure that's her default these days. We agree to cherry-pick the worst offenders and take them in tomorrow to Norton PD. At the very least, Kezia Claremont will be on our side, and Detective Prester, while not the warmest man I've ever met, is fair. He feels a little sympathy for Gwen's situation, and that counts. We should make best efforts to have law enforcement watching our backs right now. Our little community at Stillhouse Lake doesn't have its own police force, except informally in that Kezia Claremont moved into the neighborhood up the hill and across the lake from us, not far from her dad's place. Ezekiel, easy to his friends, Claremont, is a charming, feisty old guy who needs the help, though he still insists he doesn't. I stop in every other day or so, have a beer with him down on his jury-rigged and likely illegal deck, pick up things he needs. He's been up on this hill for a long time, no doubt resented by all his rich white neighbors, until the economy tanked, and most of them moved away. We came in after that. Gwen to rehab a trashed house and make it her own. Me, to watch her and prove she wasn't what she said she was. Except I was wrong. Gwen is exactly what she appears to be. She is one of the most fierce, honest women I've ever met. That wasn't a simple adjustment to make, realizing that. But once I did, I felt free, like the rage that had possessed me for so long had lifted. It scares me to think it might not have left, just circled. Maybe all that anger I let loose in the world is still out there and headed straight back for us. In the morning, we head for the police. Norton's a typical southern small town a few miles from Stillhouse Lake, and it's clinging to the edges of an economic hope and prayer. The boarded-up stores tell a story, so do the potholes in the roads. Nobody fools themselves into thinking this town's got a bright future, but they're grimly determined to make it work. I personally like Norton. I like the preservation of the buildings, even if they're standing empty. It's a place that has some style, even if Gwen often thinks of it as a lost cause. She tends to see the darker side. I try to look for the light, or at least, I've been making it a mission lately. The police headquarters hasn't been substantially remodeled since the 80s, and it's due for it, but at least the parking is generous. When we walk in, we immediately get the look from the woman behind the desk, or rather Gwen does, blank and suspicious. It isn't that Gwen's a stranger, it's that she's Gwen, and the woman on the other side of that desk knows all about her past. I lean in and interrupt the staring contest. Hi, we're here to talk to either Detective Prester or Detective Claremont. The woman shifts her stare to me. It warms slightly.
And may I say why?
It's confidential, I say, and give her a smile. It seems to work. She picks up the phone and dials. Gwen looks at me and rolls her eyes. I shrug. Not everything needs to be a dramatic face-off, particularly not with people we're actively trying to recruit as allies. In about a minute, Kezia opens the door between the counter and the rest of the police station and waves us through. She's a polished young African-American woman who's lately taken to wearing her hair in a thick natural afro around her head, and it looks proudly spectacular. Especially out here in the sticks. The individuality of hairstyle contrasts sharply with the conventional tan pantsuit she wears. It almost conceals the shoulder holster. Her badge flashes on her hip as she turns, and I hold the door for Gwen as she follows Kez into the detective area. It isn't impressive, not surprising considering the size of Norton. But as in all small rural towns, this one's battling drug cooking, addiction, and the associated crimes. It doesn't prepare her for the discussion we're about to have.
I'm guessing this isn't a social call.
Kezia gestures us to the worn chairs on the far side of her desk.
About the snake?
Gwen sighs.
Not entirely. You saw the Howie Hamlin show.
Yeah,
Kezia says.
They kneecapped you live on air. I'm sorry.
Me too.
This documentary they were talking about.
Kezia leans back for a moment, considering.
They'll be coming here. You get that, right? They'll want town footage, local interest, probably talk to some of the locals who aren't your biggest fans. And there's nothing we can really do about that. You might go to the city and try to get some kind of injunction, but I doubt it'll work.
Yeah, we didn't come about that, I say, when Gwen doesn't answer.
I have news about the snake, though. We found a fingerprint, matched it to Jesse Baldine. Jesse's one of those hillbillies I told you about, good at catching all sorts of critters. The problem is Jesse says he didn't do it, and a single fingerprint doesn't get us where we need to be to charge him, even for criminal mischief.
Kezia shakes her head.
The Baldines are a nasty bunch, and it looks like they've taken a dislike to you. Any reason why?
Gwen says she doesn't know. I don't immediately answer because I think I do, and I think it's my own fault. I clear my throat. Both of them look at me. It feels like two spotlights hitting me at once. Belle Dean, I say. This Jesse, does he happen to come to the shooting range much?
He did once, Kezia says.
Then he got banned. He came in drunk a couple of weeks ago, and someone on the range took his gun away and laid him out flat when he tried to get it back. He didn't file charges, but I heard they had to fix some teeth. Why?
I slowly raise my hand.
I'm the one who slammed him face first into the counter, I tell her. He was acting crazy and unsafe. Javier was up front, or he'd have handled that better. I guess Jesse holds a grudge.
Wait, Gwen says. You mean it wasn't about me?
I raise my eyebrows. I don't remind her that not everything is. She gets the point and puts a hand to her mouth to cover what I think might be a laugh. I had told her about the incident when it happened, but when the mountain man, Belle Dean, had bolted out of the shooting range, I'd never gotten his name, and I didn't know I'd broken his teeth. Kezia must have caught the relief from Gwen, because she says,
Well, I wouldn't get too comfortable, Sam. The Belle Deans sure love to mess with people. I don't expect this will be the last time you hear from them.
Anything you can do about them?
She shakes her head.
Catch them in the act. You've got surveillance, right?
Of the house, not the mailbox.
Point a camera that way, is my advice. If they mess with it, at least we'll have evidence.
I like that a lot better. But it doesn't solve the immediate problem.
Well, thanks for that, but it isn't why we came. We came about the threats.
You think the Belle Deans might be behind those, too? Kezia sits forward again.
Hit me.
Gwen takes the folder out and slides it across. Kezia slips open the folder, and her instant focus is on the photoshopped picture. She studies it for a moment, then deliberately turns to the next page. That's a death threat against Gwen for being Melvin's partner. It's long, and it dwells way too much on how they plan to exact justice. The next accuses both me and Gwen of being some kind of fakes carrying out a government conspiracy to convince the public that serial killers are real. It threatens to kill the kids, also actors, apparently, if we don't come forward and confess about the government's secret agenda, which they then go into great detail about, including rants about the secret cabal of the ultra-rich and the chips in our debit cards. That one is full-on unhinged, and clearly the work of someone with serious mental issues. There are a lot of threats that Gwen's gathered, and Kezia studies each one in silence before she closes the folder.
Wow, she says. It seems like an understatement. How long a period is this?
I just took the last week's worth,
Gwen says.
I expect it'll ramp up now that the Hamlin segment is available on the internet for people to pass around. That always cranks the crazy up several notches.
Uh-huh,
she agrees and leans back.
So, I can put in for warrants and traces on these IPs, but you know how it is. Not a lot of chance they're doing it from an open account that's easy to find. And if we do find them, there won't be much in the way of charges. If there are charges, there probably won't be a trial. So in the end,
costs a shitload, is a ton of time and money to investigate, and probably doesn't do any good, I say.
So your advice is, wait until one of them shoots one of us in the head and there's a real crime to investigate. I didn't say that,
Kezia says, and I recognize that she's broken out her professionally soothing voice now. I must have sounded like I was taking it personally or something.
Look, I'll do it. I'll follow up. I'll order more patrols around the lake for a while. But the fact is, none of this looks like the work of locals, especially the Belle Deans.
So nothing's going to happen to stop it, I say.
We spend the rest of our lives looking over our shoulders. The kids grow up living in fear.
Sam,
she starts, but I'm not having it.
No, Kez, don't pour sugar on a pile of shit and call it breakfast. You're leaving Gwen and the kids unprotected when people clearly want them dead. Blunt question, then. What do you want me to do about it? 24-hour guards? Bring in the FBI? They've got a division that specializes in internet threats, but they're 24/7, 365 busy at it, with a staff of probably less than 1,000 people for the whole country.
So those kids are going to be grown by the time you get their attention. I'm trying to help. I'm also being honest. Lord knows, laws haven't kept up with threats. But I'm a law officer. I can only do what the law allows.
I'm angry. I hadn't expected to be, but I wanted more out of this. Gwen, on the other hand, seems to be the one keeping her cool this time.
Sam, Gwen says, she's being practical. I didn't expect anything different. And you know how brave the internet makes some people, at least when they're behind a screen.
She meets my gaze and I look away.
I used to be one of those anonymous angry people, typing rage at her through the vague haze of the web.
We've never discussed any of it in detail, never identified specific screen names or threats or anything else I might have done during that dark, dark period. It's easier to get past it when we don't break open the scars.
Anyway, thanks for your time, Kez, really. I just wanted to make you aware of the situation so you can be prepared when something comes up.
When, not if. I note the sentence construction.
Kezia flips back to the first photograph, the one where Gwen and the children are perforated with fake gunshot wounds. This one concerns me, she says, more than the others.
Why that one? I ask. There are other photoshops in the packet. Many are worse.
It's different. Doesn't waste time on ideology or fantasy.
She cocks her head and studies it closer, picks it up and frowns down at the image.
Look, most of these assholes will draw a ton of wounds, right? The bloodier the better. It's designed to shock and scare. But this one?
She turns the photo toward us.
What do you see?
We're both quiet for a few seconds. I finally say, kill shots.
Right,
she says.
Head and chest. Head and chest. Head and chest. And if you look at where the shots are located, they're very nearly instant kills. Someone knows their stuff. I'm going to worry about that.
Oh, so am I say. Because there are very few things more dangerous than a sniper who knows what he's doing.
She's probably right, I say on the drive back. They're just desk warriors. But I want to reach out to Mike and send him the image, just in case he's seen anything similar or can find something. I'd really like to know if this guy's for real or just another shithead with a keyboard.
Gwen's not a desk warrior at all. She's survived worse than most people can imagine. I'm not afraid of a fight either, but strength and courage aren't a defense against a sniper bullet.
Check with Javier at the gun range, Gwen says, and the next second I'm kicking myself for not thinking of it first. Snipers have to practice, right? Maybe he knows somebody local who's putting in the time?
I'll go now, I say. Drop me off at the truck. I should probably check a couple of job sites, too.
Will you be back for dinner?
Depends. Is it meatloaf?
It's a running joke right now. For whatever reason, Connor's decided he can't get enough meatloaf, and it seems he asks for it at every other meal. Gwen tries not to indulge him too much, but the kids have been through so much. A little excessive serving of meatloaf seems like a small price to buy some happiness.
Not tonight, Gwen says.
Then I'll be there.
I lean over to give her a kiss before I slide out, when she stops the SUV. It turns long and sweet, and I start reconsidering going out to the range. But then I remember that every second I don't track this down could put her in more danger. So I go. My truck's seen hard use bouncing over country roads, but it's a real workhorse, and I love it, except when I get calls. Between the engine noise and the clatter, it's a bad connection waiting to happen. I don't recognize the number that lights up my cell as I climb the hill toward the gun range parking lot, but I recognize the area code. Washington, D.C. I answer and raise my voice to be heard over the engine noise.
Yeah?
Changed my number, says Mike Lustig. Thanks for picking up, my man. Jesus, what are you driving, an F-15?
Beat up Chevy, I tell him. Sounds about the same, right?
What? I can't hear you.
He overly enunciates all of it, but he's just yanking my chain.
Then you won't hear me calling you an asshole who hasn't been in touch, I tell him. How long has it been?
According to my call log, 4 months, give or take. My point exactly. Some friend you are. Settle your pasty self down. I had an undercover assignment. You'd have liked it. I got to learn how to print money. New retirement plan? Way things are going around here, might just be, he says. Government service is never exactly fun, but it's a special flavor of shit now. Preacher says this too shall pass. We got very different preachers. So, you called? You just bored? No, Mike says. He sounds less light now. Gwen just couldn't keep her damn self off the news, could she? You realize what all that means now. Creepy crawlies coming out of the woodwork again for her, you, the kids. Damn. All she had to do was keep her head down. You got any idea how much the press was on her? She needed to get in front of it and try to put it to rest. And how'd that work out? He pauses for a few seconds. Miranda goddamn Tidewell was on there. Did you see her? No. I'm glad I didn't. I haven't looked at the YouTube footage either. I can't. You don't need me to tell you that you need to stay the hell away from that, right? I don't, in fact, but thanks for thinking I'm a first-class idiot. Coach class, Mike says. No way your cheap flyboy ass pays for an upgrade. Fuck off. My taxes pay your cushy government salary. Bet you don't hear that often enough. He has a low voice and a lower laugh. It vibrates the phone speaker. Man, you can really channel your inner white boy sometimes. Listen, serious for a second. This thing you got with Gwen. Don't start it. Sam, it ain't gonna go well. You have to know that. Sooner or later, somebody's getting hurt. Probably her. And we both know why, don't we? By this time, I've arrived at the gun range. I get out of the truck. I'm silent for a little while, leaning against the rough concrete blocks of the building. The parking lot's crowded, but there's nobody outside, just me and the frogs croaking somewhere in the trees. Yeah, I know, I say. I hear you, but right now she's in trouble. I can't just go. Gwen Proctor's a survivor. You think I'm not? I think you used to be, until you let your guard down. Mike hesitates for a few seconds, then sighs. Listen, I gave somebody your number. Take the call, okay? It's important. The hell are you getting me into? Nothing you can't handle, he says. Be safe, Sam. I still care. Why? I'll never know. That's sweet, but I'm still turning you in for counterfeiting. What's that, a solid 20 in the federal lockup? See, now you're just being mean. He hangs up. I replace his old number with the new one, and I stay where I am for another long moment. He's right. Bad times are coming between me and Gwen. Miranda's reappearance ensures that, and I really do need to consider what that can mean. But not now. The longer I can avoid that particular problem, the better. I go inside and ask Javier if he's seen anyone suspicious. It doesn't make me feel better that he hasn't. Too many targets on our backs, and not a damn thing I can do about any of them. The range is packed right now, not a single lane space open, so I just hang out. I like Javier. He's a retired Marine, still young, and he's got that gravity that makes people pay attention when he talks, no matter how quietly. He can diffuse tension on the range just by walking in. Whatever disputes people are having, they generally vanish the second he appears. If I'd gone to him when Beldine started his shit instead of handling it myself, he probably would have ended it with a stare down instead of a smackdown. You want me to keep an eye out for strangers? Javier says when I get ready to leave. We can hear the steady, muted hammer of gunfire on the other side of the concrete wall, but neither of us pays much attention. It's when the firing stops that you have to worry at a gun range, because it means everybody's paying attention to something, or somebody's hurt. Trust me, I will. How are the kids? Good, I tell him. I know he still feels guilty that Connor and Lanny managed to sneak out of his cabin and get into trouble after Gwen entrusted them to his care. They're fine, and they miss you coming by. He nods, but there's a certain set to his expression that I read as reluctance. She doesn't blame you, I tell him. Not at all. You did your best to keep them safe. He
Yeah, it wasn't good enough, was it?
He says.
I know she doesn't blame me. Kind of makes it worse, man.
He glances at me, then away.
Well, I left them, I tell him. How do you think that makes me feel? You were there for them, and I wasn't.
They love you,
he says.
You made them believe in the idea of having a dad again. Don't shove that off, it's important.
It is. It's also scary as hell. I don't want to hurt them, not ever, and right now, I can't see a way of avoiding that. I don't expect the call Mike mentioned to come quite so fast, but it does, right then. I step outside to take it. Another unknown number, but this time from Florida. Miami, it looks like. I accept the call and say, Sam Cade.
Mr. Cade,
says a calm woman's voice on the other end.
Please hold for Mr. Winston Frost.
I don't know the name, but he sounds like he thinks he's important. It's only about 30 seconds of silence before the line clicks and a voice with a London West End accent says,
Mr. Sam Cade, hello. Very good to speak with you. Thank you for taking my call today.
Sure, I say.
What's this about? Mr. Lustig mentioned that I'd be calling.
He said someone would be.
Well, the thing is, I happen to have had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Lustig recently, and he heard that I was seeking a pilot for our corporate jet. He thought you might be interested in the opportunity. I understand you've taken some time off from the business, though. So,
flying. I feel a little jump in my pulse rate. It isn't deliberate. I don't want to react this way. But I've missed flying in ways I didn't even realize until this moment.
There have to be a lot of other pilots out there who'd kill for a slot like that, I say. You're calling all the way to Tennessee for a man you've never met, whose records you haven't even reviewed?
How do you know I haven't?
Trust me, those records would show my flight hours aren't exactly current.
You're speaking like a man who isn't interested in coming back to the pilot's chair.
I am, and it's a lie. I want to get back to flying about as bad as I've wanted anything. As bad as I want a home, a family, a life with Gwen. It rips me inside to even ask myself the question.
Let me get back to you, I say.
I'm aware that means no, most likely. I expect him to tell me to go to hell. Instead, he says,
Of course. You'll need time to think it over. You need to move to the Miami area, of course, in order to be on call when we need you. The salary will be somewhere on the order of $150,000 per year, the usual full benefits package. We're not in any hurry, and I do realize that in order to recertify your standing, you'll need to devote some time to retraining, and that is not an issue for us. We're happy to hire you conditionally while you complete that program.
The salary is suspiciously high, considering I don't even have real private jet experience, though I can easily get it in training.
Would I be your only pilot?
No. We employ three pilots on standby at all times. Your position would be salaried, plus overtime should your flying time exceed 8 hours in a day. So regardless of flight time, your compensation is secured.
I pause and turn to stare off toward the horizon.
What kind of company?
Sorry?
What kind of company keeps three pilots on standby at all times and pays that much money as a starting salary?
A profitable one, he says. You're more than free to research me and the company, of course. My assistant will be in touch in the next few weeks to hear your decision. Thank you for your time, Mr. Cade.
Thanks for calling, I say.
He's already gone by then, and I stare at the screen until the power goes off. Who the hell did Mike recommend me to? And what am I going to do about this? Take an interview? Lie to Gwen? Leave Stillhouse Lake? Honestly, in this moment, I don't really know. But one thing's for sure, I'm checking this guy out. Winston Frost research takes 5 minutes of time sitting in the cab of my truck with my cell phone. He's the CEO of Frost Industries, a major manufacturing outfit with plants around the world, based out of London, but with a second home in Miami and a third one in Shanghai. Pictures of him all over the web, mostly at charity events. He has the usual detractors, but he seems to be legit. I send Mike a text about it, but I don't get one back, at least not immediately. I want to know exactly how Mike knows this guy, and what he knows. Winston Frost's number tracks back to the Miami offices, so that's legit. I even redial and get the same cool-voiced assistant, thank her, and hang up. Frost wouldn't be the first rich, evil businessman I've run into since meeting Gwen. But damn, a steady job, steady pay, flying. I don't want to want this, but the fact is, I do.
Chapter 4 Lanny. I'm sitting cross-legged on the bed, laptop open, waiting for Dahlia to pick up my Skype call. It rings and rings, and I start freaking out the way I always do. What if she woke up today and doesn't love me anymore? Is that why she's not talking to me? I know that's dumb. I've been through enough therapy to know I have some issues. Subscriptions, volumes, libraries, whatever you want to call them. I'm always scared that I'm going to get hurt, even when nobody wants to hurt me. Which is why I reject people hard first. I'm trying not to do that anymore. I fell in love with Dahlia. She makes my heart race and makes me want to cry inside when we're separated, and that's what love is, right? I want to be with her all the time. I'm practical enough to know that's not going to happen. I end the Skype call and check her on social media. Her Instagram shows she's at someone's birthday party, looking bored under the poses. But at least I know she's not ducking me. At least, not today. Don't be clingy, I tell myself. Be cool. I don't know how to do that. I've tried not to care for so long that slowing down seems impossible. At least I'm not jealous. I'm not, right? I hear the front door open, the alarm warning.